Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for June 16th, 2017. And this is the clarinet quintet by Brahms with clarinetist Richard Stoltzman. This recording with the Cleveland Quartet was made in 1976, and it was one of the major turning points in Stoltzman's life. You'll hear more about it on this podcast in a conversation between Stoltzman and my colleague, Kathy Fuller. Also on the podcast is a conversation with Donald Gregg of the Orlando Consort. You can hear that British vocal group along with a performance by the Viol Consort Fretwork on the radio on Sunday night at 7 on WCRB in concert with the Boston Early Music Festival. The festival itself wraps up this weekend, and if you haven't had a chance to get to a performance and or the amazing exhibition, I hope you will. It really is an incredible event, and it's one that makes Boston distinctive in the music world. Tomorrow night, be sure to tune in to WCRB for an encore broadcast of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Andras Nelsons conducts the first and third symphonies by Brahms, and to hear his thoughts about all four of the Brahms symphonies, check out last week's episode of The Answered Question. With the Orlando Consort on the air this Sunday, I want to bring you a short conversation I had with Donald Gregg, one of the members of the group. They're in the midst of recording all of the chansons by Guillaume Dumachaud, which turns out to be an enormous amount of music. So when the consort was in Cambridge for a Boston Early Music Festival performance, I asked Donald Gregg what it is about Machaud that would make the group want to take on such a huge project.
We did a recording of Machaud several years back. I mean, he's one of the major figures of medieval music, quite simply. He was born around about 1300, dies in 1377. He's not only a great composer, he's also a poet. So he's contemporary of Chaucer's, and of course the Brits would claim that Chaucer's the greatest. But if you think about it, Machaud not only wrote the poetry, he also wrote the music. So he's a recognised figure, no question. So we recorded a CD of Machaud's music several years back for Deutsche Grammophon. And it's wonderful repertoire. It starts out being slightly daunting, slightly alienating. The harmonic structure and framework is quite different from the 15th century and the 16th century. It's less familiar. Idiomatically, it's strange. He asks you to do strange leaps. He demands a lot vocally. The lower parts have no words, so we have to simply vocalize on an open vowel and so on. So it is very strange. But once you're immersed in that musical world, and of course recording is one of the great ways to do that, because you spend a few days just recording this music, you do find certain beauty to it. So more recently we've started a new relationship with Hyperion Records, and Simon Perry, bless him, philanthropic man that he is, looked at our various suggestions of repertoire to record, and at the bottom we'd simply put something like, and record the entire Machaud chanson, which was just daft suggestion. But he immediately went to it and said, yeah, we should do this. And we're saying, are you sure? He said, how many CDs? Well, we haven't even worked it out yet, but it's going to be 15 or 20 CDs.
That's astounding, 15 or 20 CDs.
Absolutely. It's going to go on. It'll run and run. So we've recorded several so far, and two have been released. Le Roi dit, which is a narrative poem by Machaud, which we're doing in concert this evening, which links these different songs with readings explaining what the structure of the poem is and why the pieces were written. It's Machaud as an old man writing to a young woman. That's not as perverse as it sounds. It's very much in the tradition of courtly love. It's charming rather than in any way suggestive or lewd. And then the second half features a lot of music from our second CD, which has been released, called The Dart of Love, which moves into motets, not just chansons, and also features some rounds, a couple of rounds, one a chasse, which is about hunting and so on. So you hear these battle cries as well of people, you know, chasing after hounds and deer and so on, and falcons. They have falcons as well in the chase.
If this is going to take 15 or 20 CDs, I can't imagine it's going to be sort of 15 or 20 CDs of more or less the same thing. What do you anticipate the ensemble will need to do to pivot and calibrate differently as you go through the project? How did Machaud's music evolve, in other words?
It's actually very difficult to talk about an evolution in Machaut's work because he continually revised the work. So it's all of an exceptionally high quality. I mean, you know, you usually have composers split into three eras, you know, their immature years, their mature years, and then the dark years at the end of their life. In fact, Machaut was continually working on his poetry, continually refining, revising these compositions. So you can't talk in those kind of terms. For us, it'll just be a luxury to spend that much time on that one composer. And on the page, sometimes, although they look strange, they don't look too complicated. But of course, when you record them, the more you sing them, the more you discover the intricacies, the kind of things that obviously a music historian, a musicologist would write about and analyse to the nth degree. But we're actually doing that process while performing it.
And there are four of you in the core of the group. Sometimes you expand with others, but how then do you take on the is there a leader for the overall project or for the different chapters of the project?
Well, we're very fortunate insofar as we have very good friends who are music historians, and they are creating the first really modern edition of Machaut in modern notation. There was one done in the 1950s, a famous one, but it really hasn't been done in this kind of detail. So we have these friends, they are friends, musicologists who are beavering away, going back to the original manuscripts, correcting the kinds of mistakes that were made in the 50s for various reasons, going back to, you know, absolutely pinning it down. So in a sense, they're helping us with providing additions and also ideas as well, ways of structuring the discs so that they're not just endless chansons, something thematic. The second CD, for example, is about Machaut quoting other composers and so on, and also himself being quoted. So there's that sort of link. Angus Smith, my colleague, is responsible often for the programming. So he, again, has a complete thorough spreadsheet of all of Machaut's work. So it's a question of, it's a jigsaw puzzle, really. And it's evolving. We haven't plotted absolutely everyone and so on.
You're just arrived in Boston here at First Church in Cambridge, and just watching you rehearse a little bit, it's clear that you make adjustments as you go. What do you find when you show up in this space? What did you find in rehearsal that you needed to tweak about what you're doing?
Essentially, it's a very live acoustic, and it's very soupy, we would say. It's a beautiful acoustic to sing in, don't get me wrong. But because there is quite a lot of detail in the music, we've had to slow some of the tempi down. Not to any degree that an audience would think, oh, you took that very slowly. It won't be like that, and it's a micro adjustment. And also, perhaps for the reasons of clarity, we'll put a slight front at the beginning of notes and so on. And maybe simply because acoustics respond differently to different frequencies, you know, the lower parts perhaps have to just sing a little bit more, the higher part might have to tuck things in slightly, maybe sibilants can be toned down a bit, maybe some of the plosives, the P's and B's and so on, need a bit more effort and a bit more work. Those are the kinds of things that any musician would do in, you know, in a different hall.
So I want to run one little story by you. I saw one time Anonymous 4, and it happened to be that I was like in the second row or something like that. I was right on top of them, and I was stunned because they actually didn't sound alike. And I listened to the recordings. There's a beautiful, beautiful sheen of an all-alike sound. And then I went back into the hall a little bit, and it did blend more. But what I found was, or at least what I think I found, is that the real blend happens with the articulation of the beginning of that note. And you just said that you changed the front of the note. And am I onto something here about how a group develops an ensemble sound, that it's not just the tone, there are other ways that you do it?
Well, there are certainly matching vowel sounds. That makes a big difference. I mean, we spend a lot of time on authentic pronunciation, for better or worse.
Okay.
Not for reasons simply of authenticity, but because it means we're all aiming for exactly the same vowel. So that will also add a certain sort of uniformity to the sound and therefore blend. But actually, one of the things about our group is that our voices are quite distinct. And we don't shy away from that. We don't try to create some sort of more vague ethereal sound. Nothing wrong with that at all. But we think within the form of a collective that individual expressivity is important, and part of that character of the voice needs to come through. So we like those different colours.
Yeah, well, terrific. Don Gregg, thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with me after a kind of busy day, I'm sure.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Donald Gregg is a member of the Orlando Consort, and you can hear them on WCRB in concert with the Boston Early Music Festival this Sunday at 7 p.m. Also on that program is a performance by the Viol Consort Fretwork with soprano Susie LeBlanc. Each week on the radio and online, WCRB features a recently released recording that seems especially interesting, and right now it's quite a bit more than a single recording. It's a 40-CD set that encompasses the career of clarinetist Richard Stoltzman. My colleague Kathy Fuller, a good friend of Stoltzman, got together with him to talk through that amazing career. And I'll bring you their conversation in three parts over the next few podcasts. Here's part one.
The box is like a, not a Pandora's box, it's a kind of open box to my heart.
Clarinetist Richard Stoltzman talking about a brand new box of 40 CDs, the complete collection of his albums from 1974 to 2007. He played the first clarinet recital ever given at Carnegie Hall. He's won the Avery Fisher Career Grant, 2 Grammys, and over the decades, millions of fans. There's just no one like Richard Stoltzman. The fact that his 75th birthday's coming up feels a little surprising to him, but this box set came as an even bigger surprise. I'm Kathy Fuller. I sat down with Richard Stoltzman to talk about the recordings and to hear a few of his many stories. You know, I want to know, how did you find out that Sony was pouring your life into this beautiful box?
It was a complete surprise. I was going through the emails that you get on your phone, and there was one from Germany, and I thought, I don't know, should I junk this? Is it a race? I don't know the person. And just said, just to let you know that your 40 CD box of all your recordings over the past, 40 years will be finished in a few weeks. Would you like to say a few things about it? And I who is this guy and what are they doing? Nobody asked me. Of course, not that I would say no, but nobody asked me. So it was a delightful surprise, totally. So the box is like a, not a Pandora's box. It's a it's a kind of open box to my, really to my heart.
The first concerto that you recorded was in 1980. It was Mozart. I remember when you were here in our studios not long ago, a few years ago, and you said, Mozart Clarinet Concerto is the top of the mountain. I can still hear you saying it's the top of the mountain. Is that still true for you?
Well, I've had so many great concertos written for me, and they are the top of my little mountain. But maybe the mountain of music, especially as the world goes, Mozart is up there pretty high, and that he wrote something for the clarinet, in fact, is already great. He decided that the clarinet was worthy of his voice, you know.
Why did Benny Goodman tell you what key it's in before you played it at Carnegie Hall?
I don't know if I said that in the book, but why he did that, I think was, it's the first time, last time and only time I ever got a telegram. I don't even know if they send them anymore, but I kept mine. And it was something I was backstage and I thought, do I want to open this? You know, but I saw it was from Benny and what's he going to, I'm sort of nervous and this is the first time to play Mozart Concerto. Anyway, I opened it up and he just said just exactly that. Good luck. Don't forget what key it's in, Benny. And it made me so change my mind about how nervous I should be about going on stage at Carnegie Hall to play this piece for the first time, because now he was saying, well, just remember what key it's in. And that I know it's in the key of A. I have my A clarinet. And now I thought, I bet, because Benny pretty much played the B-flat clarinet all the time at band and everything, he might have maybe walked out on the stage or in a rehearsal with his B-flat clarinet, and they said, Benny, we're going to do the Mozart, you know. Okay, fine. And he forgot what key it was in. At any rate, that's what I made myself think about, and it just worked because I no longer was thinking about myself. I was just saying, Mozart, no, it's in the key of A, you know.
That's
great. It worked terrific.
It's an audience in their underwear kind of moment.
Yeah,
right?
Just, yeah. Right. Yeah, except in the right key.
Let's hear a little. This is the first concerto recording that you did for RCA. It was the Mozart concerto.
Yeah.
And let's just take a little listen. You know, it's a few feet off the ground. Does it still sound wonderful to you as it does to us?
It's surprising. You know, I'm always traveling in my life on and on and on and wanting to do better and continue to grow and all that kind of thing. And so, consequently, I tend not to return to projects and music that I've done because I'm thinking I've got to not bathe in the past. I have to, you know, yes, get out there and start thinking about what else I should be playing and how I should be playing. But the gratifying thing about this box, I have to say, is that it's 40 years, but I think, geez, I wasn't so bad 40
years
ago.
I'm telling you, there are some baths in here worth taking, Richard Stoltzman. Well, that one, you know, is beautiful. And I remember you do talk about that recording. You didn't like the sound when it first, when they first handed it to you. This is what happens with recordings. The artists get usually what's called the first edit.
Yeah.
And they hand it over to you and you sit down with it. And I've seen many artists just go, oh my God, this is terrible.
Well, I wasn't, you know, going to say, oh, I should be doing it better or something. But I thought I shouldn't really say anything. Who knows if I'm ever going to make another record? This is my first and maybe last. And the person who was in control of the project was Jack Pfeiffer, who was Heifetz's a producer. And so RCA thought, well, you know, we'll give this guy this young man, the best we can do. So, but it was so dry.
Dry.
And I
so
was,
that means it didn't have that full, billowy, beautiful,
right,
round sound.
Right. And I was warned by the man who had worked with me prior to RCA and then began working with me at RCA, Max Wilcox. They said, Dick, you know, they're not going to let me do this, because we have a conflict with the guy at RCA, blah, blah, blah. So he said, yeah, but I know you want to do it, but just remember, you're going to be recording in the CBS studio, not a hall. And they're going to have everything mic'd, everything, individually. You know, and I didn't even know what that meant. I just thought, I'm lucky guy, I'm going to get to play. And I didn't care, you know. I just didn't care. And so I was sort of, what do I do? I'm supposed to, like, really thank everybody for doing this. But anyway, Tom Shepard, who was the president of RCA, you know, hello, Tom, I'm sorry to bother you. You know, and he had his desk full of Grammys and everything. And, Dick, you're back from London. Yeah, okay. So how did it go? I said, well, it was pretty good. Could you just listen to a little? So he said, okay. So he got a studio and put it on, and he right away he had the reaction, which I'd hoped he would have. He said, oh, no. And I remember he got on the phone. He said, have somebody call my wife and tell them, you know, I'm not going to be home for dinner. And then he got somebody else to go find the master tapes and broke them all down, because everything had been recorded, every horn, everybody. So, and he completely redid it. And he did stay there until almost midnight.
Wow.
And at the end, he said, okay, I think we're going to be satisfied now.
Pretty gorgeous result. And well done. Well worth knocking on that door. Well, you know, you went to Yale, you studied in math and music, right? And then you went on to study in to study music, right? As a master's degree?
No, I went to Ohio State and studied math and music. And then when I got to Yale, I decided I'm not going to be able to count that high, so I better just stay with music.
So you met Peter Serkin there?
Well, not at Yale, but I met Pete
At Marlboro.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and he was on the fringes. He was hanging out there. You know, his father was the boss of everything, and he was there. I mean, he loved the place, but it wasn't his place. But he heard we did a performance in the dining hall of the Messiaen Quartet for the End of Time. So he heard it from the outside, because the dining hall, and there's windows, and he was listening from the outside. And he knew the piece, of course, already. He loved Messiaen, and he was thinking about trying to play this piece, really, not just play it, but rehearse it and work on it and everything. So he caught me outside the dining hall, and he said, you know, you want to rehearse this piece some more down in New York sometime? I said, yes, yeah. Sure. And we did that for, I think, about 8 months.
Wow. So that was around 1973. Three, that you actually became Tashi. You named yourselves Tashi.
No, we named ourselves. We didn't know what to name ourselves. We couldn't think of a name. So, but Fred Sherry, the cellist, was sitting in Frank Solomon's office, our manager, our future manager, and they were getting calls from people to book us to play the piece again.
This is the quartet for the End of Time.
Yeah, the quartet. And so, okay. So Frank said, well, so, Fred, we have to have a name for the group. And I told Peter we can just call it the Peter Serkin Quartet. And he said, absolutely not. I don't want to have that idea that Peter Serkin's group. I want it to be all of us, you know. So couldn't think of anything. And then Fred said, well, look, are you going to book this concert? Just call it. We call it the name of Peter's dog, which was Tashi. So that was it.
That was it.
We named the group after Peter's dog.
That's fantastic. Well, this Messiaen Quartet for the End of Time, you grabbed the consciousness of the world with it, and it was your first recording as Tashi. And it really, it has such a history. It was 1940. Messiaen was in
a concentration camp
near Poland, and found these four instrumentalists.
Incredible.
And wrote this piece about the revelations about the mighty angel from heaven in mist and a rainbow on his head. And he declares the end of time. This is ecstasy and rainbows. This is the ecstatic music of Messiaen. And I think it just grabbed everybody at that time in the world. And it must have been something so amazing to perform this live. People must have reacted incredibly.
Yes, it was. It was like no other kind of music that I'd ever played. And it was in, as you say, the spirit of the times was hungry for this kind of revelatory and ecstatic music. And we played the hell out of it because we rehearsed this piece, as I say, for about 8 months before we ever even tried to play it once. And we kept at it and at it and at it and thought about it more and more. And finally, Peter was able to, what's her name, Yvonne Loriot? Anyway, the
Yvonne
wife
Loriot,
of,
right.
of and asked her if Miss Anne would come and coach us on the piece.
How was that?
That was something a little more scary than I thought. I remember very vividly Messiaen, who was a very tall guy. And, you know, he wasn't interested in our performance. He had the score, and he just looked at the score the whole time. He didn't even look up. He's the next page, you're looking, you know, and things. And then he would comment. I tried to play my heart out, but he was sort of more interested in things like there's a place that goes dun, 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 and he came up to me and said, you know, I said, all right.
That's ecstasy.
Well, we wanted this
yes.
thing. And then
precise ecstasy.
One other thing I remember, and the theme comes like, dum, 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 dee, dum, 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 dee, but much slower, but in an octave lower. And he's standing over me, and he said, noir, noir, noir. And I played again, you know. I tried to play noir, but I wasn't quite sure how noir I should play it, you know, and noir, dark, you know, and so I got more scared, and then my breath got more, and I was pressing on the reed and getting this kind of gritty sound.
Amazing.
And when I did that, he stopped. I mean, he let up on that. I guess that's noir.
Well, when you think of what he was thinking of when he wrote the piece and the atmosphere that was there, I mean, to get the players to recreate that.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of that because I was in 941 Park Avenue. I was exactly. not in a prison concentration.
The Brahms Quintet. Was that the piece that made you fall in love with the clarinet?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. And I'd never heard it before, I must confess.
Doesn't get much more expressive than that, and that is such a heartfelt outburst.
Yeah.
How does that feel to you? This is the Cleveland Quartet, 1976.
Jeez.
How does it sound to you?
It makes me kind of sad. All those guys are. I mean, they're still around, but they broke up a long time ago and
Katz,
retired.
Paul Katz, Martha Katz,
yeah.
Peter
Saloff
and Donald Weiler.
Yeah, and I've played the piece so many times since then, and I'm sort of old now, so the piece, the fact that he wrote this after he retired and said, I'm not going to write anymore. And then he heard the clarinet of Richard Mühlfeld and decided to create this masterpiece work. And to play it with a quartet, you have to really become intimate with them. It's not the thing is, you don't rehearse in the sense of getting things in the right place. You get a sense of how emotional or how joyful or how whatever that we can find this music to be. And so I think it makes me a little bit teary.
That's a good thing, though. Takamitsu. Let's just talk about him for a second. He meant so much to you. Great Japanese composer who I know became so important to you.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. His aesthetic was so wrapped up in the sound that an instrument can make, the sound, the breath of it, even before the sound. And he really wrote for me the concerto that he wrote for me, Phantasma Cantos.
There's almost a this sad kind of resignation sometimes in his music. Then it gets very full of life, but then it kind of settles into this natural world. It's like a haiku. Well, not really. It's like it floats a little bit, you know? It's lovely.
Yeah. And he uses all these effects, of course, as a contemporary composer would. But he begins to take his philosophy of life into the music, and you hear him and his way of approaching nature and individual musicians. He always said, you know, I'm not going to write music anymore except for people that I know love.
Wow.
Me and the music.
You tell a funny story about the BSO in Ozawa, and you're playing his quatrain, and you, what happened there?
Yeah. This was a weird. It was in Carnegie Hall, and it was a very, very important time to play this piece that he had written. Not the one we just heard, but the quatrain. And you know, so we were all into it. Peter, everybody in the group, and Seiji was. But the thing is, Takamitsu wrote music that he would write eighth note equals 38. And then he would say, slower than possible. So you know, Seiji's doings were all into it. And at one moment, you know, I'm looking over. I can see Peter from the corner of my eye. And he's looking at me. And we're looking at him. Where are we? I don't know where the blankety-blank we are. What's going to happen? I don't know. You know? Carnegie Hall, and the Takamitsu's there. So anyway, afterwards, we were in the green room, and everybody was thanking. And so just I went over to Toro, and I said, Toro, so beautiful. This is such a great honor, and I'm so sorry. And he looked at me and said, what? Oh, that place. I wish I could write music as beautiful as that. So he got me off the hook of knowing that we had screwed up when we were where we were supposed to be for about 15 seconds. But he also implied that the ideal for him would be to have music that was almost improvised.
Wow. That's amazing. Somehow I don't think Beethoven would have said the same. Well, speaking of composers who have written for you, Steve Reich, you did New York Counterpoint. That involves playing a track and then recording another track, right? And how many tracks are there?
11.
11 of you.
But who's counting?
Right. And why did it sounded like when you tell the story, you have to play them all front to back, not without stopping.
Yes. Well, I mean, when I learned the piece, I got my part, solo, the solo clarinet part, and I was practicing, I remember, in my living room, and Peter John, my son, who was probably around, I don't know, 8 or 9 or something at the time, I was playing. Dad! Fix the needle on the record. It keeps skipping. I said, no, that's Dad's going to play that piece. So
So here's another piece that is really a product of its time, really caught the imagination of everybody.
Yeah.
But so you had to record each one of those parts beginning to end, and if you screwed up, did you have to start all over again?
Well, the thing was, Steve was there. He was absolutely going to come to the recording session, which I thought, oh, he doesn't need to come, you know. It's not like I'm going to make a mistake or something. But so I recorded my solo line first, which was number one, and then it goes down 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. And after about the fourth, this is on, you know, it's reel to reel. And after about the fourth clarinet part I'd played through, I realized that I was getting sharper. Because I'd been playing for about half an hour, and the in the heat of my air into the clarinet had made the clarinet go higher pitch. I said, oh, shoot.
That's not what you said.
But, you know, and I thought maybe they won't notice it. Steve said, you know, I'm not sure about the intonation on that last track. And then I said, okay. So here's what's happened is I've been playing now for a while and my clarinet's got, so he said, okay, well then, and I said, what do you think we should do? And he said, well, we'll just start at the beginning again from the very first take of the beginning and play the whole piece. I mean, when studio people or engineers or composers, they say we, they mean you actually, but
yes.
Yeah, we'll start over. So it was really a test of my not only of my endurance but my control of how I wanted to play, because I'm an emotional guy, and every time I played a little nuance, Steve would say, "No, we don't need that.
No nuance.
No nuance. Just play the notes." And I was fighting that a lot. I really was. And it's only later that I realized that this was the way the composer heard the piece was this way. And it wasn't my job to make it, quote unquote, you know, musical or more expressive or something. No, I was supposed to play with. And I told my manager, I probably will only play this once, Frank, so, you know, sorry. Anyway, I probably have played this piece hundreds of times, more than any other piece, maybe.
Wow.
Yeah, because he knew what he was doing, Steve Reich.
Yes,
he knew what he was doing.
And you can learn more about the new release of 40 CDs by Richard Stoltzman when you visit us online at classicalwcrb.org. That's where you can also hear the Boston Symphony and WCRB in concert on demand. Again, that's all at classicalwcrb.org. On the next episode of The Answered Question, I'll have part two of Kathy Fuller's conversation with Richard Stoltzman. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or through your favorite podcast app, and you'll also find us on WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to Donald Gregg and Richard Stoltzman, as well as the staff of the Boston Early Music Festival, and Frank Solomon and Associates, and Sony for making these conversations possible. And thanks also to Kathy Fuller. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.